Hadassah harassed. Now, you don't hear the word Hadassah too often when you read in the Bible, but in Esther you do. And who is Hadassah? They are one and the same, aren't they? I don't think there are very many stories in the Bible with as much intrigue, with as much drama and violence. You could make a thriller, a cliffhanger for today's entertainment and not get any better story than what we have in the book of Esther. It's phenomenal. Opulence of royalty, celebration, feasting, and drunkenness. A rebellious queen, regret and loneliness, Cinderella-type transformation from being a conquered foe to becoming queen, bad guys versus good guys, conspiracy to eradicate an entire nation, risking a life to save others, comeuppance of the bad guy. Underdogs becoming heroes. As you read, you get the sense that there is a power, something invisible behind all of this that is in control. And only a few people involved in it recognize this. There's a bigger plan than just the day-to-day activities being portrayed. There is violence and there is prayer. There's arrogance and pride and there is humility and submission. There's presumption and there's faith. There's deception and greed, and there is purity of purpose and trust in God. What a setting. And what is the setting for this story? What's the background? Where are we in time? There is a period of time where everything is in chaos. There's wars. You think that we have wars a lot today? They may be more frequent today, but they were never ending back in those days. We're talking about approximately 500 BC. Now, this whole story, of course, where do you start with history? Maybe a good point to pick up on this one would be back at about 550 BC, about 50 years earlier, with Cyrus. You remember how Cyrus was prophesied about 100 years before he came on the scene of action. Well, it's about 64 years before some of this happens that Cyrus started up his beginning of power in the Achaemenid Empire in the area not far from where Iran is today. He began, and about that time, he started coming into prominence. Well, let me get my glasses back on here now and get this down here. Xerxes' father, Darius I, and by the way, how do we pronounce that? When I was a kid, I was always told, oh, that's pronounced Darius. Okay? When I came to this church, I found we had a young man in it as a son of the folks sitting here on my right. They pronounced it Darius. I thought, boy, that's different. Well, if you go back to some of the words that we have in the Bible and you look for some of the original pronunciations, I'm finding there's a long A in that word, Darius. And they were using it right. Darius I was the father of Xerxes. Xerxes is one of those guys that we have another name for as well, Ahasuerus. That's how I learned that one. And, oh, Xerxes was a name too? Well, that's fine. I'm finding there's double names on a lot of people. Come to think of it, most of us today have two names ahead of our last name. This isn't unusual, is it? Okay. Xerxes' father, Darius, had become king in 522. Let me see if we can bring up a slide here that should show us. Well, okay, let's get it turned on. There we go. Where are we? We're supposed to be on a slide instead of where we are. Oh, I went backwards. Thank you, Jaden. There we go. Now I know you can't read that from back there. But those green bars up there talk about things that have to do with Esther herself. And the beginning on the left side over there for you is a starting point of about 522. That's when Darius becomes king. Now, Darius had been fighting in Greece and Egypt since 492. That's a little while. Now, remember, all of these numbers are going to get smaller and smaller and smaller the further you go to the right. We're before Christ. He was defeated when he attacked Athens, then again at Marathon, and then Egypt rebelled in 486 B.C. He was making plans to conquer Greece when he died. Then Xerxes, his son, was crowned king in 486, chose to carry on his father's campaign against Egypt and Greece, defeated Egypt in his second year as king. Following these victories, we read about a grand celebration. Now, this is a lengthy celebration, half a year, 6 months. That's one that lasts and lasts, almost out-celebrates itself. During that time, they probably were planning the attack on Greece. This had to be well planned ahead of time. So Xerxes is now feeling very confident, ready for battle. And he is now ready to celebrate in a different way. I'm going to show off my beautiful wife. And beautiful wife Vashti says, no. And we can only conjecture as to what was going on in her head. But when that happened, Xerxes comes unhinged. Gets very, very upset. And he turns to people that he trusts. And he says, what shall we do with this woman? And what do they tell her? So, after dethroning her as queen, he spent the next 2 years planning and preparing for the attack on Greece. All the logistics had been talked about. Now they're ready to start putting the supplies in place, building the ships or whatever are needed, and then they head for Greece. It's in June 480 BC that he arrives at Hellespont on the coast. At first, he's very successful. It's easy going. But it doesn't last that way forever. He meets a major defeat at Thermopylae. Next month, he conquers Athens. So it's up and down. Lost the battle at Salamis. A few months later, he was defeated again at Mycale. So he headed home discouraged. That's the background to what's happening here now. A military genius that is not on top of it all the time. It is at this time that we read about a beauty contest to bring joy back to Xerxes. What's happening with the Jews at this point? They're not in Jerusalem. Why are they in Susa or Shushan, depending on where you're reading this? Why aren't they in Jerusalem, folks? They rebelled against God. That's not the smart thing to do. It was back in 597 BC. This is going back quite a few years now. We're at 480. That's 114 or 117 years, depending on whose chronology you're using. Well over 100 years earlier. Jehoiakim surrendered to Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar took most of Israel prisoner, and Mordecai's family was taken to Susa. That's 100 years earlier. So we're not talking about Mordecai being taken. His family was. Okay? Mordecai and his young cousin, Esther or Hadassah, were born there in Susa. They never saw Jerusalem before that. They'd lived their lives all the time there. Esther's parents were dead. Now, there's multiple stories about how these lives were lived and what happened and so forth. And if you go back and study the Jewish histories, and I say that in the plural because you can get multiple versions depending on who you're reading, you'll see that probably her mother died at childbirth. Her father may have already been dead at that time or may have died shortly later. There's no consistency in that. So Mordecai, an older cousin, takes Esther or Hadassah into his family and raises her as a daughter. So she's known no other parents except him. Now, back to Xerxes and his lack of companionship. Well, what do they tell him? I think we ought to go get you a new queen. And so what do? They populate the harem. Now, if you think that this is something that the ladies all look forward to, consider the following. The ladies that are drafted for this purpose go to a building or a complex, if you will, where they are prepared throughout a year of beauty treatments for a one-night stand. For most of them, after that one-night stand, they go to a different complex and they stay there for the rest of their lives. This is slavery, not celebration and freedom. Not something you want to look forward to. Life was tough back in those years, guys. It really wasn't nice. And it was for the benefit of those with power. Esther, somehow or other, meets the needs of this man. And he says, this is the woman for me. Crowns her queen. And she goes off to this other location now. How often she gets called back, and you'll notice that later on in this story, she mentions, I haven't been called for over 30 days. Fellows, how often do you see your wives? I hope it's more than every 30 days. Yeah. So this isn't something where there is connubial bliss and they're together all the time. No. In fact, during these times, he's going off to war and coming back. In fact, during this time, Babylon rebels and is destroyed. And then he's back home again. Like I said, this is one of those stories that has a lot of involvement of violence. Haman comes into the picture. Who is this guy? Turns out he actually is a relative through the Amalekites. Okay? So he is a relative of the queen. He doesn't know that. He may have had some inkling of this, but it's not something that he was fully aware of. Okay. Now he's a big man. A lot of authority. And the pride goes to his head. And there's a gentleman there that he's a little bit miffed at, by the name of Mordecai. You know the story. Mordecai does not seem to be as subservient as he should be. So Haman plans a revenge. And what happens? Well, some plans are made, and he decides that he's going to do in not just Mordecai, but the whole race. Genocide is not nice, is it? Well, Haman deceives Xerxes and succeeds in getting a death warrant for the entire nation, which does not set well with the Jews. They go into mourning and wailing and wearing of the terrible clothes with the ashes all over them. And Mordecai is out there in the public street bemoaning himself. And what happens? Of course, he's not coming around to see how Esther's doing, and Esther finds out all about this and says, "What's going on?" And when she learns about it, she's not happy either. But she learns who's responsible for it, and she also gets the picture of what she's expected to do to fix it. Now, the process she chose might seem a little bit lengthy and awkward to us today. We're more inclined to go to the point and say, "Here's my problem, let's do something about it and fix it." At least the men in my life, that's the way we work. You ladies, you're more subtle. You do things in a much gentler way. But in her day, even though she was the queen, she understood the role that women must observe. She took her life in her hands. Actually, of course, was it in her hands or was it in God's hands? I mentioned that there's a power, an invisible power behind the scenes. And she had called on that power, hadn't she? She had told Mordecai, all of the Jews should fast and pray for 3 days. And my ladies and I will do the same. Well, get a picture of where this is in time and space. Let's take a look at some of these locations. Let me get my glasses off so I can see here. This is the ruins, if you will, of that temple, not a temple, a palace area where they were living. And this is a drone's view from hundreds of feet up. You can come down to a little lower and see. There we go. Another view that includes not just that area, but the city that has developed. This is a current view today. That's a complex that's considerable size. Here is a gate that is the entrance to the area probably where Esther actually resided. And this gate is where Mordecai, outside of this gate, would have been where he would have been mourning in the streets. This very gate. You see the pillar, the bases of the pillars there on the edges of the gate. Those could have been quite high. We don't know the size. And from the inner court, this is the view toward which she would have entered to make her plea to Xerxes for their lives. This is the view that would have been there without the building. That's what you see today on the ground there. The area that they were in is a flat area. It's not. It's sort of a plain. No trees to speak of nowadays. Don't know what there was at that point. And she was taking her life in her hands to go in to see if she could intercede. And you know the results. And what does she do? She does not say, "You got to fix this, guy." Very, very diplomatically, "Come and have a meal with me. Oh, and bring Haman with you." And there at that meal, "What do you want?" "Come again tomorrow." In that interval of time that occurs, we see God at work again, behind the scenes. What does God do for Xerxes that night between the two banquets? "No, Xerxes, you're not going to go to sleep tonight. Bring me something to read." What's this about Mordecai? Have we ever done anything for him? That previous evening, Mordecai was being planned for destruction when Haman and his friends and his wife said, "Put up a poll." Now, when I read about this in the King James Version, it did not appear to me we were talking about a pole with a sharpened point on the end. In fact, I think the word were gallows or something like that. And that sounds to me like a different kind of thing than I am seeing in many of the translations. But the more I studied, the more I recognized there was a common way of securing a permanent end to a person. It's by sticking a very sharpened end into them, right through them. Sometimes it went in this way, sometimes it went in this way. And a pole 75 feet high was being erected for the benefit of Haman's pride. And it was going to be the resting place for Mordecai. So, the next morning, Haman comes to the palace to request from Xerxes, "I want you to kill Mordecai." But before he gets to open his mouth, Xerxes asks him, "What do you think I should do for somebody I want to honor?" Wow, boy, he must be talking about me. "And you've got to do something marvelous. Put him on the king's horse. Put him in the king's robes. And present him to the people as one you want to show honor for." Wonderful. Go do this for Mordecai. What? No! Can you imagine how Haman felt. But Haman is not stupid. He wouldn't be in the position of authority if he were. He does it exactly as he described. But can you imagine how he feels after this is done? Total humiliation and mortification. And he goes home totally crushed. He can't even get recovered before they come and it's time to go to the banquet, Haman. So he's there with the king for the banquet. And now God says to Esther, it's time. Tell him what you need. And she does. And how does she describe Haman? This wicked Haman. Wow. What a huge 180 degree turn of fortunes. And you remember the story. The king is so outraged, he leaves the room. Haman stays there to plead for his life. And he is so completely out of control that he can't even stand up straight, and he falls on the couch where Queen Esther is. The king returns, and it appears to him that something is going there that shouldn't be happening, and they take Haman away. And they tell him then that, oh, by the way, Haman has a gallows or a pole set up in his backyard for Mordecai. Put him on it. Like I said, a little violence here and there. Ups and downs, you cannot ask for a better cliffhanger. But of course, that isn't the end of the story, is it? Because now, what's the king going to do? Well, of course, what he does, he starts out with, okay, Esther, you've got Haman's property. That's yours. That's not a bad start. But I can't undo the edict. So what does he do? He says, you guys write some kind of a law that doesn't violate that, but allows you to defend yourselves. Oh, and by the way, I got this ring, my insignia ring, back from Haman. Here it is, Mordecai. You can sign anything now with that, and you're in charge. Not bad. So from almost a year away, that's how long it is before this destruction edict was to take place. The Jews are preparing. And the mood goes from one of those Jews, I don't like them, to I think we'd better get acquainted with those Jews and get along with them. Even so, there were still enemies that were destroyed when that time came. quite a lot of them. We know of at least 75,000. That's a lot of people, folks. A lot of deaths. So the Jews were not all that popular. But many of the folks, I shouldn't say many, it was known that there were quite a number of folks that wanted to become Jews because of this. And they were welcomed. So the Jews became the heroes. So what happened after this? What was the outcome in the lives of Xerxes and Esther? Do we know of any children? Yes, we do. We know of a son. And the secular histories tell of a very well-respected daughter, a powerful lady. We don't read about her in the Bible at all. But the son we do read about. His name, he took a name for, as the king, he was Xerxes' son, as Darius the Second. Darius the Second was raised with a sympathy for Jews. Mama was a Jew. And when it came time for the rebuilding of the temple, Darius the Second was the one that produced the edict that made it possible. God has a way of working things out, doesn't he? Isn't it beautiful? The least shall be the first. So what is there in this story that we should learn? First of all, let's talk about the things that we shouldn't want in our lives. Can you identify one personality characteristic in a hurry that should never be part of our lives? What do you think it might be? Pride. So let's look for some of the good things that we see here. The willingness to submit. The word submission isn't all that popular, but it has its place. The Jews were submissive, and they get along fairly well. What happened when Esther had to go to the king? She had no assurance that she was going to be able to walk in there and tell him what she needed. She had to be submissive to him. There had to be faith in God and appealing for his guidance and for his protection. Those are things we want in our lives. An awareness of what's going on around us. In my world of emergency communications, awareness of the conditions is of high importance. Being aware of risks to our safety, of opportunities to move forward with reconciliation with problems so that we don't have unnecessary dangers around us. There is a boldness of very, very carefully measured boldness that Esther had when she went to the king. That was an important part of it. And yet there was humility all the way through this. I think of these as characteristics I want in my life. I think all of us would be happier if we lived these ways. The song we sang for opening for church, "I'll Go Where You Want Me to Go," was chosen with this in mind. She went to the king. Where are you asked to go? Are you aware of where he wants you to go? Are you listening for his voice? The last song that we're going to sing is also on this theme. Is your all on the altar? If I perish, I perish, were her words. Well, if you perish here and you are in God's will, you have a future, an eternal future. What more can you ask from God than that?